Good afternoon, calling State Affairs to order at 3:21 p.m. Thursday, March 29th in the Max Grunberg Room of the Capitol. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Wolf?
Here.
Representative Ledoux? Representative Birch?
Here.
Representative Johnson? Representative Tuck?
Here.
Representative Knopf?
Here. And with four members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. Representative Knopf is excused absent and out of town. To kick off the meeting before going to the series of presentations, wanted to quickly knock out a motion to forward conferees, whatever the right word is for that, to joint session. Representative Wohl.
I move that the names of the nominees before the House State Affairs Committee for the State Commission for Human Rights, State Parole Board, Personnel Board, Police Standards Council, Public Offices Commission, and Public Defender be forwarded to a joint session for consideration.
Seeing and hearing no objection, so moved. And for context and for the record, all the names were circulated to members of the committee. If anyone expressed a desire to hold a confirmation hearing for any nominee, we would do so, but no names were singled out. That takes us to our presentations today. We have three presentations. First, from Angela Rodell, CEO of Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Second, from David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division. And third, an overview of permanent fund proposals in the legislature from Reed Magdan's staff in my office, as well as Rob Irvine, staff to Representative Jennifer Johnston. We'll start with Ms. Rodell. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for dealing with the rescheduling over the last week plus, and glad you can join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and it's a pleasure to be with the committee this afternoon. The presentation you have before you is focused on the governance in terms of talking about the corporation and the fund and what we do and what we're managing. The request was to really drill in on the governance aspects of it, but I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about the corporation as we move forward. So one of the things that when talking about the fund is sort of putting it in the context of how this all came about. In 1969, Alaska received $900 million in Prideaux lease sale bonuses. At that time, the unrestricted general fund operating budget of the state of Alaska was approximately $178 million. So this was a huge windfall to the state in that respect. I think it's also important to remember that in 1969, the state had been a state for all of 10 years, and as part of the statehood debate, they had talked about how it would support itself as a state and what it would do. There were a lot of pent-up demands, and so the $900 million was quickly spent on needed projects across the state. That level of spend, though, did concern legislators, and a debate began about whether or not that royalty, which was a non-renewable resource, and it was unclear how much of that resource was truly available, would be available to benefit future generations that weren't around in 1969 to benefit from that $900 million lease sale. The debate was really among three different uses: to fund state infrastructure and social programs, to establish a development bank, or to create an investment fund. And as we know, the decision was ultimately to create an investment fund. That fund was created through a constitutional amendment that was approved by the voters in 1976. And Alaskans voted by a margin of 75,588 to 38,518. So I like to point out that there was not uniformity in the decision to create the permanent fund, that in fact there were people who believed very strongly that it in fact could be used for other purposes rather than an investment fund. The language that is within the Constitution is actually quite simple, and it's Section 15, and this is all there is to it, is the paragraph that is on slide 3. And it says that at least 25% of all mineral lease rentals, royalties, royalty sale proceeds, federal mineral revenue sharing payments, and bonuses received by the state shall be placed in a permanent fund, the principal of which shall be used only for those income-producing investments specifically designated by law as eligible for permanent fund investments. All income from the permanent fund shall be deposited into the general fund unless otherwise provided by law.
And if I may, just a quick question on this slide. Has there been a point in time where more than 25% of royalties have been deposited into the permanent fund?
Mr. Chairman, there has. And so as leases have been approved over the years by legislative bodies and the terms of those leases and what the royalty was, there have been determinations within those statutes. And, in fact, if you look at our statutes on and I can cite you the exact statute here if you give me just a moment, but it's that we're entitled to royalties in excess depending on when the lease agreement was entered into or what the field was. And I want to try and get you that site if I can. It may be that I have Pullen follow up with you on where the deposits into the fund come from, but I know there's a specific site that recognizes the different fields and leases that were written as time went on.
Thank you. Representative Birch.
I wanted to know for the record that I was one of the 75,588 votes in the Walner.
One of the things to note here as well is that when this language passed, the first deposit came in 1977, in February of 1977. It was $734,000. It went and was managed by the Department of Revenue. The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation did not come into being as the entity responsible for managing until 1980. So there was a time where Department of Revenue had responsibility for managing. The allowable of investments were initially simply fixed income bond investments, and over the years that list expanded to the point now where the direction is to follow the prudent investor rule. So that leads me to governance. So the corporation passed SB 161 in 1980. It established the corporation and provided in its findings that a sound management structure to maximize the fund's ability to generate investment returns, and it created a board of trustees that were entrusted with the fiduciary oversight of the fund itself. Our mission is in statutory language. It says quite simply that we are to manage and invest the assets of the permanent fund and other funds designated by law. Currently, today, we do have one other fund that we are responsible for managing, and that is the Mental Health Trust Authority Principal, and so we have that responsibility as well.
And I'd like to note for the record, Representative Johnson joined us at 3:29.
So what does it mean to be a fiduciary? Because I find that a lot of times we use the language of the fiduciary, and then when we get asked, well, what is a fiduciary, it's very hard. We know it when we see it, but we're not quite sure exactly what it might be. And so for the public's benefit, a fiduciary is relating to the responsibilities of a person or organization that manages property or money belonging to another person or organization. So it's recognizing that we have a responsibility to someone other than ourselves for how we manage, and that we answer to someone outside of ourselves for how we manage property or money. In Alaska Statute 3713.120 is where the investment responsibilities for the corporation lie. This is where you will find the mandate to use the prudent investment rule. This rule requires the test of fiduciary conduct to be undertaken from a portfolio formulation perspective. So I think it's really important to understand how these two relate to each other. The prudent rule, prudent investor rule, requires us to take a perspective of construction of that portfolio without consideration to performance. subsequent performance, which I think is really interesting because it might seem counter to what you would expect. But rather, you should assemble a portfolio of assets with a risk tolerance that you believe is suitable for the purposes, term, the distribution requirements, and other conditions of the trust. And then that then generates a return that we see. So when we talk about how we structure our portfolio and we conduct our asset allocation, we do it not to drive returns, in a sense, because otherwise you could argue that we should be 100% in private equity, which has the highest returns for 2017, or that we should be in public equity because it also has higher returns. It has better liquidity, and so if you think you need more liquidity, you would choose public equity. But we don't do that. We assemble this portfolio, this asset allocation, with an eye towards what is our risk tolerance. And that risk tolerance has to be set in terms of what is the purpose of this fund. And the primary purpose of this fund is to hold these monies in trust in perpetuity for all current and future generations of Alaskans. That also speaks to the term. So you can take different types of risks depending on the term. If you know that you're going to have 10 years to ride through different business cycles, that's a different risk profile than if you're going to need the money in 6 months. Distribution requirements feeds into that assumption of term. How long are we going to have the money to be invested for? And any other conditions that you might place on the trust that are imperative to the objective of the trust. And so this is I'm sorry.
Quick question from Representative Gray.
Before you left that slide, I was just curious about the difference, if there is a difference between a fiduciary and a trustee. And then second to that, what sort of competency expectations exist for one or both of those positions or you know?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, so I'm a fiduciary. My portfolio managers are considered fiduciaries, and it's because we've been entrusted with those responsibilities. The trustees have a even higher standard because they are ultimately the ones being held responsible for the actions of the staff and the delegations that they are making. So the trustee has a higher legal standard in many ways, and they have the right to, as I said, to delegate certain responsibilities down. We're all fiduciaries, and if I back up to that definition of fiduciary, we have certain responsibilities in managing. So in other words, we have the ability to manage certain trades day to day, which is what makes us fiduciaries. We place a fiduciary standard on our external managers, right? But the trustees themselves are ultimately responsible for the trust itself. The statutes do have requirements on the Board of Trustees in terms of qualifications. They are, the qualifications are that the four public members of the board must have recognized competence and wide experience in finance, investments, or other business management related fields. And then the other two members of the board are the Commissioner of Revenue and another member of the Governor's Cabinet, as he so chooses. And currently, that is Commissioner Andy Mack.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I imagine that the trustees have a fiduciary responsibility, but they're not necessarily fiduciaries. If any trust happens to be sued, can a fiduciary be sued also? I know the trust members can, or the trustees, but how far does that go down the chain?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, my understanding, and we may want to follow up with a little bit of clarification, but my understanding is that all fiduciaries can be held personally liable to the extent that there is criminal activity associated with whatever the failure is. So there's tests applied to your failure as a fiduciary, whether it was through circumstances beyond your control or whether or not it was knowingly and intentionally a violation of that duty. Mm-hmm. So when we look at slide 8, what we think are the key determinants of our success, it's that we have, and what keeps funds like the permanent fund successful, what we have in common is that there's an effective independent management and organizational structure. There's an adherence to accountability measures. We have defined legal and regulatory responsibilities. We have established policies and procedures. And we at APFC are considered a leader in establishing best practice standards. So to give you some sort of perspective on how we participate in this world of sovereign wealth funds, it was really interesting. In October of 2016, the Pew Charitable Trust actually wrote a report on sovereign wealth funds and this movement from volatile sovereign taxes to a sustained revenue model. And I believe we sent this report in its entirety to the chairman's office for the committee's benefit. But one of the key recommendations and recognitions from this is that governments are now using sovereign wealth funds in order to deposit a portion of revenue in an investment account that's intended to generate returns that will be used to achieve a specific public purpose or set of goals. And I think one of the challenges that we have today is that specific public purpose or set of goals is what's really under debate. And so recognizing that that's the challenge for the state of Alaska, but how important this is to how the Permanent Fund Corporation governs and manages the sovereign wealth fund is key to understanding why the Board of Trustees has taken some of the actions that they've taken to date.
And I might just interject on that last slide. There was obviously much publicized legal analysis from the legislature's counsel, I think relating to what constitutes public purpose or benefit, and relating to a piece of legislation that was considered in the House Finance Committee and legal speculation whether that would lead to the fund being taxable. Mm-hmm. And I was curious if APFC has had its own counsel explore that question now or previously in history, or if you have any thoughts or commentary on that question.
Mr. Chairman, we have not had separate counsel. We've relied on Department of Law and over the years as to what their interpretations and to the extent that they've reached out to other law firms to help inform them if they don't feel like they have an expertise in a particular area. It is our understanding that it's not clear exactly how that would play out. I think we recognize that, sort of what we all universally agree upon is that the permanent fund is an asset of the sovereign that is the state of Alaska, and what that public purpose it ultimately gets used of may have potential tax consequences if there's a viewpoint by the federal government that in fact it's for private benefit and not a public benefit. You know, we all know over history there are times where there's a lot of attention paid to this, and then there are times where it's really quiet and there's not a lot of attention paid to this. And so we have not seen the need to get private letter rulings or to get additional opinions on this because, from our standpoint, the legislature appropriates the earnings of the permanent fund. And that's where it stops for us. You decide how much you draw. We don't make the determination as to what purpose, once it moves over to the general fund, what purpose it's being used for.
Thank you. Or actually, maybe let me ask one follow-up question. To your knowledge, has the Department of Law or any outside firms that the executive branch has retained to explore this question led to different conclusions than what legislative legal has expressed?
My understanding is that over the years, there have been differences of opinions expressed, but it's been, my understanding, it's been years since it's come up in conversation or discussed. But at one time, there may have been a potential disagreement between Department of Law and Ledge Legal on this matter.
Thank you.
That's why I'm glad I'm not a lawyer. So moving on, we thought it might be helpful to pass along what the Pew recommended for U.S. state policymakers when it comes to sovereign wealth funds. So the first is to identify the purpose of the sovereign wealth fund and clearly articulate its goals in law. I'm happy to report that what we have in our statutes surrounding the permanent fund do articulate a clear goals for us, for the fund, and for the corporation. To establish policies for the governance, investment, and public disclosure of the fund's activities and law. Again, we believe that we have very clear guidance in our statutes for how we will govern, how the trustees will govern, how we will invest, and how we will disclose. We're required to make annual disclosures by September 30th of each year as to the performance of the fund. We have oversight in statute by the Legislative Budget and Affairs Committee. All of our board materials go to each member of the LB&A committee. They do have oversight. Pew recommends that policymakers provide statutory or constitutional guidance regarding withdrawals from the principal. So this, we have had statutory guidance in the past, and we continue to urge statutory guidance in the future with regard to withdrawals. And finally, to have that awareness of the volatility of earnings from the fund. And I think we've had a number of really good discussions about the volatility, and that's been apparent in the markets in recent weeks, just how volatility can affect the fund. In terms of best practices, by establishing these independent entities like the Permanent Fund Corporation, they called us out in the New Zealand Super Fund as a best practice entity to ensure that prudent governance, monitoring, and disclosure of their financials and management practice, and they stand as examples of many of the best practices for sovereign wealth funds domestically or internationally. I just feel obligated at this point to point out you don't see Norway on this slide. You see Alaska and you see New Zealand. And we were very proud of getting this shout out and I think this is important for Alaskans to realize that we got recognized for our governance and how the state had established the fund and continues to have oversight, governance, monitoring of the fund. Finally, just getting to the inflation proofing, to the resolutions that have passed, and I'm probably getting close on my time, so I can move through these quickly. The Board of Trustees, in terms of their governance and their mandate, have two things that have caused increasing concern. So in December, they passed Resolution 1701 on inflation proofing, and this came about because of 3 years of non-appropriation for inflation proofing and protecting at least a portion of the fund for future generations of Alaskans. September. So in September, they passed this resolution, and it specifically directed us to pursue legislative support for inflation proofing, the principle of the permanent fund, so that the purchasing power for all generations is protected as stated in our statutes, AS 3713020. Earlier this month, the Board of Trustees went further and passed Resolution 1801. This is to encourage a rules-based framework for fund transfers. This goes back to the desire to have a known distribution requirement or policy. As they said in the resolution, we've had a long tradition of following a rules-based system for withdrawals and saving. And since our inception, with the exception of certain one-time deposits into the corpus, the state has adhered to a combination of constitutional and statutory law to manage cash flows into and out of the fund, as well as between the corpus and the earnings reserve. And we strongly urge you to continue to follow a tradition of following a rules-based system, whether it's the one currently in statute or the one or one to come, because we understand under statutory it is perfectly within the legislature's purview to adjust the rules as we go along. But having an adherence to a rules-based system is a basic element of best practices for us for the management of sovereign wealth funds. And so we reiterate that a system provides a clear basis for deriving the expected time horizon and the efficient investment policy for the savings and promotes stability and accountability for us. In particular, they actually had five specific tasks, and the one which I'm pleased to be here with you today is to distribute that resolution and offer to follow up in testimony in support of the need to follow a rules-based framework. So thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk about this resolution in particular and reemphasize that in order to do our fiduciary responsibilities and follow the prudent investor rule, part of that is a requirement on distribution. So with that, I'm happy to answer any additional questions that the committee may have.
And first, I should note Representative Johnston has been here since almost the beginning of the meeting, so I should be sure to recognize her, and also a lot of appreciation to her and her staff for helping with today. I have just a couple of questions, Ms. Riddell. One, in terms of a rules-based framework, I wanted to ask if you could comment on the value of rules being in the Constitution versus rules being in statute. And as a manager or as protecting the real value of the fund for future generations, how you see those two differing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what we need to recognize is the need for flexibility and what we need to be flexible about and what we don't want to be flexible about. So by putting in the Constitution at least 25%, there was a recognition that we were going to be inflexible as to the minimum amount that was going to go to the permanent fund. But we recognized that there may be times where we wanted to put in more than 25%, right? And there was a recognition that times change. And so the language says, let's just have the income go to the general fund unless otherwise provided by law, which could mean you could go directly to the dividend fund or to some other fund, constitutional budget reserve, right? You could, but that mechanism would happen statutorily rather than in constitution because times change, things happen, and you need flexibility to operate. So I think when you're looking forward to what needs to happen, you have to weigh carefully the decision between what is immovable and unchangeable, because this hasn't been touched since 1976. And this was a debate that started in 1969. So it went for 7 years, if I'm doing my math correctly. It went for 7 years before this became a constitutional amendment and hasn't been touched since then. So we don't change the Constitution easily or lightly. And so as we draft these things, we have to remember that aspect of it. And that what should stay in statute, arguably, is those things that should remain flexible. And I would argue maybe that's the purpose, that's the expense of the permanent fund, because things move around a lot. And there's a lot of needs and a lot of unforeseen events that you might want to be able, future legislatures might need or be required to adjust how they use this fund. So that's just one example.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, in reading the constitutional amendment, and I remember it, and I was actually looking at it the other day regarding the all income from the permanent fund shall be deposited in the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. But as I recall from an earlier briefing, the permanent fund in total is around $65 billion, but the corpus, it's actually, the permanent fund in the earnings accounts are $65 billion, but the corpus is about $40 billion. And of that $40 billion, only about $16 billion was actually put in per the constitutional provision, and that the legislature mm-hmm. subsequent to 76 have actually supplemented that to build it up to 40. Is that a fair statement or approximately?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, that is correct. In terms of clarification, $16 billion is that lease royalty payment. About $7 billion were special appropriations over the years where, for example, there was a time where after dividends and inflation proofing, if there was something left over, they would sweep out the account and put it back into the principal of the fund, right? So that type of thing added up to about $7 billion. And then an additional $16 billion came from inflation proofing. Almost $16 billion came from the inflation proofing appropriations.
Follow up. Last year we did make an attempt to introduce an inflation proofing measure, and do we have a sense of where we should be inflation proofing wise? Is it kind of built in, or would there be some? Is there some sort of institutional or forecast, or is there a number that you need to kind of put in every year to kind of inflation proof things, or it sounds like the three deposits that have happened. One is to put the actual fund together, $40 billion in the corpus, that's actually included several supplemental appropriations. And I'm just wondering, what would we be doing today that would protect the fund, the corpus of that fund, in perpetuity? Would that be a number we can come up with? Or?
So, through the chair, Representative Birch, in the governor's proposed FY19 budget, he restored the appropriations for inflation proofing for fiscal years 16, 17, and 18, which total approximately $1.4 billion, and then a separate appropriation for the FY19 estimated to be $942 million. That is calculated based off of actual inflation rate, CPI as published, and it is calculated on the principal of the fund. So it's not on the entire assets under management. It's on that principal corpus. And you can see, if you look at the individual years, FY16 would have been a $47 million appropriation versus the $942. So you can see both the rise of inflation, but also the effect of and really what it is that rise in the inflation and some of the growth in the fund compared to, but it really is how inflation has shifted in the last 4 years in creating a bigger deposit requirement to maintain that purchasing power of the $40 billion, which then becomes 42, and then you do the inflation calculation on the 42. So it's to get to recognize that there's a compounding effect that happens with that.
Yeah, it strikes me as a very reasonable thing to do because the corpus, the actual the fund itself, the permanent fund itself, any of those realized earnings or gains that you would normally, like if it was your IRA or something, it just kind of stays in there and, mm-hmm. and perks along. But in the way the fund is set up, all those earnings are technically accessible to appropriation and statutory management and so forth. So if we're not inflation proofing the permanent fund, it isn't going to grow. Other than the 25% that's deposited?
That is correct. Through the chair, that is correct. And then speaking of the 25% in statute, and I think I just looked right at it and just skipped right, but section 3713.010 has the different percentages that would come. So it does have that 50% of all mineral lease rentals, royalties, net profit shares, under AS 3805-180, F&G, and federal mine revenue sharing payments on leases issued after December 1, 1979, and 50% of all bonuses received by the state issued after February 15, 1980. So that goes to your question about whether or not, Mr. Chair, we've put more than 25% into the fund, and statutes have been written to do that, but the appropriations last year and took it down to the 25%.
And a question. Yeah, a question I have based on one of the resolutions that the corporation has passed, is it fair, safe to say that the corporation and you support retroactive inflation proofing for the years the legislature has failed to inflation proof the fund?
We do support that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Well, I think I know the answer, but I'll just ask it anyways. So, where is it? Sovereign wealth funds, and of which Alaska Permanent Fund is one, and Pew made recommendations for state policymakers, best practices. Alaska, New Zealand, Norway is not mentioned. I'm sure there's many other sovereign wealth funds out there. Are we the only one that pays out a dividend, and does that matter?
Through the chair, Representative Woolen, I guess I should clarify. It's not that Norway has bad governance. I just liked that the shout-out was to Alaska, since a lot of times we get asked how we compare it to Norway. I think we are – I don't think. I know that Alaska currently is the only one that pays out a dividend. North Dakota set up its legacy fund when it had the shale oil boom that happened, but they put a moratorium on the dividend program. They weren't going to pay any dividends out until the fund was at least 5 years old, I believe it was. So it may be reaching the point where they're now considering whether or not they should pay out a dividend, because when North Dakota set it up, it was just 6-7 years ago, so there was a lot of interest in mirroring what Alaska had done. That would be the only one that may be getting ready to launch a dividend program. I don't know where the status of that is at this time.
Follow up.
Well, I guess when I asked, does it matter? And I'm wondering, did North Dakota call you for about any of this? But does it matter? In other words, if a fund is producing wealth, as wealth funds are supposed to do, and you draw off it 3-4 whatever percent to forever whatever purposes, does it really matter where it's going? And from your point of view, you're just saying this is what we're earning, this is what we're mm-hmm. producing, spitting out, or whatever you want to call it, and you guys do with it what you want. Mm-hmm. Is that basically how you look at it?
That's exactly right. Through the chair, we need to be indifferent. I mean, we may care as individual Alaskans, but we need to be indifferent as to the use, because what you're asking from us is to create, is to recognize a liability payment. And if you think about it, maybe in PERS and TERS, it's what is that annual beneficiary payment going to be? And we don't care what the beneficiaries use their receipt for. We just know that we need to come up with X amount of dollars to pay that benefit. And this is sort of that same concept, which is, what is the number? What is the bogey? Is it that you need us to hit to target? So,
follow up.
Yeah, thanks. And thank you, Mr. Chair. So as far as inflation proofing goes, if your bogey, say, was lower, a lower demand, 1-2% or something, then the inflation proofing would be sort of taken care of by the fact that you're drawing a lower number. Is it that simple?
Through the chair, I wish it was, Representative Wool. And the reason it's not, is because of the construct of the earnings reserve account versus the principal. And so long as you can always have the ability to do an ad hoc draw up to 100% of the earnings reserve account, you're We're always going to be asking for an appropriation for inflation proofing to make sure that the principal gets to capture back some of its purchasing power.
Last one.
Follow up.
So I guess what you're saying is if it was simply one fund instead of earnings reserve and principal, then my earlier scenario would be much, you wouldn't have to inflation proof as long as you didn't take off too much.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
A question based on those questions. What would you say the merits are of the earnings reserve account corpus structure versus an endowment model, if any?
From our standpoint, there is very little merit to the earnings reserve account corpus structure. From our standpoint, for ease of managing the investments, we having it all as one fund that has a very strict endowment payoff is very clean to account for, and as an investment, it meets sort of all those criteria I listed before, which I'm going to see if I can find under the prudent investor, which is we get to build a portfolio that recognizes the purpose. You're going to pay off X percent. We know the term. It's all now in perpetuity. There's not some that has a different term than the corpus. We manage right now as if both buckets have the same term, but the debate that has happened over the last 3 years makes it very clear that they don't have the same term. The distribution requirement has changed considerably, but we don't have a requirement yet. So I think if you had it as one, I get the merits from your perspective, from state policymakers, why keeping them separate has a lot of merit.
Can I see if I can put words in your mouth? That perceived merit is that we have a big pot of money that we can get at when need be?
Through the chair, there's that. There's also a limitation as to how much you can get at, because I think one of the fears I've heard about making it one pot is, oh my goodness, now you're really going to spend all of the principal, without recognizing that, as Representative Will talked about, sort of the balance of not overdrawing and being able to recoup what you spend based on what you set that amount at.
And I'm sorry to cut things off. I've been notified that there's a floor session right now.
Oh, congratulations.
So we're going to go at ease and sort of assess things from there, but thank you for joining us. Representative Birch, a comment?
I just want to take the opportunity to thank you. I know we kind of push you down the schedule here earlier in the week, but thank you for a great briefing, and I appreciate the good work you're doing on behalf of all Alaskans. Thank you.
I would ditto that. Thank you very much. Going back on the record, Mr. Thiel, thanks for hanging with us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just a point of order. Do you want to send a note to other committee members, maybe just alert them that the committee, just as a data point?
Yeah, we'll get the word out.
Thanks.
That discussion could go on for hours about what you can spend, what you can do, and I know that was an at ease, and now we're back on record, so I guess we shouldn't talk too much about what happened there. What you asked me to do was kind of give an overview of fiscal plan or fiscal planning, and probably what I should do first is try to define what a fiscal plan is. And many of you may know that this isn't round one on trying to develop a fiscal plan. I think it's probably round five or six or maybe more, that it goes in cycles. Every time we have low revenue, people say we need a fiscal plan, and then oil in the past has recovered, and fiscal planning goes, who needs a plan now? We got lots of money. Ideally, it's when you have a lot of money that you should develop the plan, but it's never worked that way. So, again, what is a fiscal plan? I remember in one of the early rounds of fiscal planning, open for public comment, and one man's comments were, so why don't you just say what you mean? You see, that fiscal plan, that's just bureaucrat speak for, you want to tax me and take my PFD. And that's not far from the truth. That's really what fiscal planning is, if you think of it back to using bureaucrat speak. A fiscal plan addresses revenue, spending, and use of reserves to balance the budget. Well, he got two of them, use of reserves, PFDs, or supporting government services. Revenue, the only one he didn't really address directly was spending. And that's the third of the three options you have for balancing the budget. It's the three legs of fiscal planning, if you want to think of it that way. And so now, how do I compare the fiscal plans? And that's really difficult because the only fleshed out fiscal plan out there is the governor's. He submitted it, a plan last year, revised it this year, submitted it again. And although individual representatives and senators have their ideas about a fiscal plan, some are even introduced as legislation, and I won't go through that because that's in the PowerPoint that Rob and Reed will do. But neither body has reached consensus, and I think we're still waiting on the House. We were thinking there might be consensus today on a House fiscal plan, but there still isn't. So they evolve over time. The House can have a fiscal plan now that may change in a week or month, and the Senate hasn't really come forward with a fiscal plan this year. They might argue that we still have SB 26 on the books. We would like to get it out of conference committee where it now resides, and that's still our plan. But other senators have said, well, we've got some tweaks to that. But again, no real consensus. We, Legislative Finance, of course, have a model that's designed to help you with fiscal planning. And it allows many user inputs to be changed. And I didn't bring that today. It would be far too complicated. I hope to take just a few minutes here to talk about some of the elements, and particularly on use of permanent fund earnings, because to get into the model and the various taxes that can be imposed, what you can do with spending, with cuts, with growth rates on expenditures, all gets very long and involved. And the focus today is really on the permanent fund, more specifically the use of permanent fund earnings. And there are several reasons for that. It's by far the most powerful tool you've got. Your fiscal deficit runs right now about $2.6 billion. Using permanent fund earnings, as proposed by the governor, closes about $2 billion of that gap. Taxes, at most, were about $700 million. So it is a very significant, in fact, the key tool in fiscal planning. And one thing our model tells you is that balancing the budget without using permanent fund earnings is really difficult. We cannot make it work without using earnings. Another thing the model tells you is that the difficulty on agreeing on a plan, a more comprehensive plan, meaning reserves, expenditures, and revenue, The problem is not that there's no solution. The problem is that there are lots and lots of solutions.
And a quick interjection, Representative Wall.
Here's a quick question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a $2.6 billion deficit, and the governor's plan would fill up about $2 billion. And just back of the envelope, if there's $60 billion in the fund and you take a 5% POMV, wouldn't that be $3 billion? And where's my error there?
Through the chair, there's no error. It's the in the governor's POMV plan, and in most of the POMV plans, there's a payout. Okay.
Oh,
but that payout.
I know the answer.
Goes. Well, I'll say it anyway.
Yeah, I get it.
The answer is that only $2 billion of that goes for public services. The remainder goes to dividends.
Yeah. Silly me. I'm sorry.
But you got it. And it's an important point. So we're looking now at not on spending options, not on tax options, but just on use of the permanent fund earnings reserve. And you have to be careful here to say earnings reserve. We're not using the permanent fund. We can't. That's not available to us. So given that we've been arguing about POMV or percent of market value payouts for, what, 4 years now, maybe five, you may infer that there's some deep-seated opposition to the use of permanent fund earnings or at least irreconcilable differences in plans. I may be that I'm insufficiently sensitive to these differences. I consider a lot of the differences to not really matter much, and the plans, I think, are very similar in concept. They differ in details, but that's okay. For instance, most of the POMV plans have a five-year look back. That's generally agreed upon as a very nice, stable payout. And you talked a little bit earlier about the difference between using percent of market value versus earnings and the dangers there. Again, I've seen Rob and Reed's PowerPoint, so I'm not going to get into that. That's in their slide deck. I don't imagine we'll get to theirs today, but I'd be happy to come back and sit through their presentation either today or later. And if you have more questions of me, then I'd be happy to answer them. So the five-year look back, common method, it's largely because it's stable and government needs stability. You can't simply start up a program, I don't care whether it's foster care or Marine Highway System. You can't just say, well, we'll shut it down this year because we're low on money, and then we'll start it up next year. The people are gone. The infrastructure is gone. Programs tend to last a while in government. There are discussions about the payout rate. It's actually a fairly narrow range. I think there's one plan that has 4%, but most of them are 4.5% to 5.25% payout. And I think there's some confusion about what we can afford, what's sustainable, however you want to put that. And some of that comes from the permanent funds comments, and I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just that if you do the math, really simple math, they say they're going to earn, we hope, 6.5%, and inflation's 2.25%. That gives you a 4.25% sustainable payout. But then we know that there's a look back. So the payout, the nominal payout, if you were to say 4.25%, isn't paid on the current value. It's a 6-year look back. So if you think of it in simple terms, it's a payout based on the balance of 3 years ago. And therefore, since the permanent fund is growing all the time, the effective payout rate is always lower than the nominal rate. So we could say that's a 25 basis point difference. So we can afford a 4.5% payout, clearly sustainable based on inflation. But the permanent funds also said that their target rate of return is a real rate of 5%. Again, that would indicate that you can have a 5% sustainable payout and then say, oh, well, you got the look back, so it could go as 5.25 and still be sustainable. So, my attitude is it doesn't really matter. This is not a big range. Pick a number. They all work. The difference is that if you pick a low number, your payout will be lower in the early years, but because your payout is lower, the fund will grow, and your payout in the future will be higher. If you pick a high number now, you get more money now, which also means the fund won't grow as fast because you're paying out more, which means that in 20 years or so, those lines cross. And what you're really arguing about when you say, should it be 4.5 or 4.75 or 5 or 5.25? It's intergenerational equity. Do you want more now, or do you want more left for future generations?
Do you have a sense, Mr. Thiel, of other sovereign wealth funds where they sort of center or what the median POMV payout is?
Anywhere in this range, Mr. Chairman. It depends. I think the key to these is what Angela Rodell talked about briefly, is that you can say you've got a payout rate of 4.25 and it's sustainable and it's great, it's low, we can do it, and then you find that except you still got a big deficit, and if the deficit would be large enough with a payout that low that the CBR gets burned up in a couple of years, at which point you say, well, we either have to tax or spend or use reserves. And the easiest thing to do is just say, well, we'll take the 4.25% payout and then an ad hoc draw. So your 4.25 becomes 4.25 plus $800 million. That doesn't work. 4.25 or even 5.25, that all that would mean is that your ad hoc draws would be lower because your stated payout is higher. But you simply cannot do ad hoc draws and have a sustainable fund. You pick a sustainable payout and you stick to it. As soon as you go with ad hoc draws, you have not protected the permanent fund. You have not protected dividends. You have not protected government because you will drain your reserves.
Just a quick question. I was going to ask, what do you think of a constitutional amendment that would prohibit ad hoc draws?
Mr. Chairman, that's a tough question because statutes clearly cannot prevent ad hoc draws. The Constitution is the only way to prevent ad hoc draws. So the only really safe way to have the permanent fund support government, support dividends, is to put it in the Constitution. But the Constitution becomes very inflexible. There's no ad hoc draws. Now what do you do? There may come a time when an ad hoc draw becomes necessary. The Constitution on setting up the permanent fund has worked very nicely for a lot of years because it's really vague. 25% minimum. It doesn't say the maximum. It doesn't tell you what to do with the money. It just says put it in investments. Well, Alberta used to have what they called a heritage fund, permanent fund, larger than ours back in the early days. But they invested it in government buildings. Why not? Because we need government buildings. And the trouble is, there's no return there. You have no money. You have no assets other than a building. And you're using the building for housing government workers. So do you really have a permanent fund at all? So our permanent fund is very wisely stuck to financial investments, not infrastructure investments in Alaska where there's little to no return, cash flow return to the permanent fund. So I'm a little nervous about a constitutional amendment, but it's the only real protection that the fund can have. But it assumes in many ways that you would go to an endowment plan. I don't know if you heard the testimony in the House Finance Committee when they heard a bill creating an endowment. It was pretty obvious that either the public doesn't understand endowment theory at all, or they have a great fear of government, or both, because they were very concerned that if you have an endowment instead of a separate earnings reserve, that you would simply begin spending the corpus of the fund. But endowment theory says, yes, that's possible. At any time you're saying we're going to spend, whatever, 5%, you may not have earned 5%. Your earnings may be low for several years, and you may dip into principal. The point is, in the long run, you can pay your 5%. You will have better years. You will have better business cycles. And that in the long run, pick a sustainable yield, and as long as you earn enough to make that payout plus inflation, then you have a fund that grows and continues to spin off 5%, which would be a growing amount of money. I mean, that's why universities and foundations and others use endowment theory instead of trying to run off earnings. Earnings are inherently unstable.
Yes,
I do have to leave. Can I have one question for Mr.
Yes, and Representative Birch, you're still in the queue. Noted. Go ahead.
Well, because the constitutional issues come up, and we're looking at the section of the Constitution here, and this one says at least 25%, and then it says all income should be deposited in the general fund. So it's not saying it's getting a minimum of what goes in, not a maximum, and it's saying once the earnings go into a general fund, it doesn't say what you have to do with them. So to protect the permanent fund, if you had an endowment, a true endowment model, I guess as we're calling it, and you want to protect the fund and you say, okay, this is your draw, but you don't say what you have to do with it. I mean, and I guess that's where in the last week or two they're talking about a constitutional amendment saying this is how you divide the earnings, and I think that's where a lot of people are uncomfortable. And just like there's education listed in the Constitution, but it doesn't say how much goes towards education. And I guess I know the chair has been interested in endowments and constitutions. So
very interested in constitutions, Representative Ball.
Well, I guess I'm just saying that this, as it's written here, leaves a lot of latitude. That's kind of comfort maybe you or others like you might have.
Well, Representative Wolf, through the chair, notice the last little clause there. Unless otherwise provided by law. It is otherwise provided by law that the earnings reserve account is part of the permanent fund. So it is not in the general fund. It resides by law in the permanent fund. Easy to change. But it doesn't change the fact that the entire earnings reserve, despite the fact that it's considered part of the permanent fund, is fully subject to appropriation. And, of course, that's the underlying problem all along here. But it wouldn't matter if that earnings reserve were in the general fund or stays where it is. The point is it can be spent at any time, in any amount, with a simple majority.
Thank you. I gotta go.
Could build a lot of university buildings and Fairbanks. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, David, for your kind of briefing. I think the buck is going to stop with the 60 legislators and the governor in this Capitol building, I'm thinking. And I think personally, there's 61 people with a vote, and there's probably 61 opinions, but in my view, a POMV approach is reasonable. It provides a steady, predictable draw on an annual basis. One aspect that, you know, everybody looks at, and I think the Supreme Court last year basically made a determination that a dividend is not a birthright. It's basically a line item in the budget. In my view, it ought to be, if you can't, you know, reduce spending appropriately, then you have an obligation to meet that financial obligation. What's wrong with paying our bills first, and then if there's money left over for a dividend for those who need it in particular, let's do that. And to that point, has there been any work done on a needs-based dividend, but I know constantly in the course of discussion, again through the chair here, there's 25,000 Alaskans that will be pushed into poverty. I mean, I think I've heard that 50 because that's always the argument. You know, it's not the fact that I'm going to get $2,700 and my wife and my six kids. It's always the people that really need it are the ones that really are struggling. Well, what's wrong if we just have we ever looked at making the distribution, if it's necessary to keep people from freezing to death or starving to death, making that appropriation and needs-based, and I just don't know because I haven't been here long enough, but through the chair, do you have any observations on that?
Sure, through the chair, assuming you can reach an agreement on payout, and I don't think that's difficult. I think that's a narrow enough range and that, you know, it's not a big deal. The split for dividends is a big deal. There is no real economic rationale for dividends, I mean, government rationale. We're the only sovereign wealth fund that pays dividends. You got to ask why, and whether we can afford it. It's paying dividends is really a political decision with large fiscal impacts, and I say that not because of the impact on the people of Alaska, but because every dollar spent on dividends adds a dollar to the deficit. So that dividend split becomes a real fiscal issue, because if you had, let's just say an $800 million deficit, and coincidentally we're paying out about $800 million in dividends, well, if you brought a consultant up here from down south and said, we can't solve the problem, do you have any ideas? He'd probably say, wait a minute, you're paying out $800 million in cash, which no one else in the world does, and you're asking me how I can possibly fill an $800 million deficit. This seems like too easy. Don't pay dividends. And we have had proposals ranging from, you don't pay a dividend if there's a deficit, all the way to you pay a full PFD, statutory PFD, despite having a deficit. So there's no right answer to this. This gets to what you said. There are people who have grown to rely on those dividends. And really it becomes a political decision when you have constituents who may not understand the fiscal situation, but certainly understand that I get my dividend in October. I better get my dividend in October, because if I don't get my dividend, I'm not going to be voting for you anymore, because if you voted to reduce it or eliminate it. So again, it seems to me the decision is political, and it's really difficult for someone to be angry with any legislator that votes in any way on that dividend, whether it's to eliminate it or double it. because they're all, you are all voting on what you believe to be right. And there's simply no right or wrong on these dividends. As long as you understand that every dollar you pay in dividends increases the deficit by a dollar. And then you have to figure out how you're going to address that larger deficit. It's
all said. Thank you.
It's not easy.
Thank you.
Ad hoc draws, we talked about a bit. They are a big deal. Can I ask?
Sure. Given your knowledge of what's happening in the building right now, what probability would you assign that there is going to be an ad hoc draw in the next, this budget cycle or next budget cycle by the legislature?
Can't answer that because I don't know what you would consider an ad hoc draw. Remember last year there was...
Can I offer a definition? Anything greater than, say, 5.25% of POMV.
Okay, and I would respond, what about last year's draw that we didn't take? I mean, remember, SB 26 is still in conference committee. It's been there for a year. And if it comes out, it's got an effective date of 18, which means let's approve it. Well, now you have an 18 draw. Is that an ad hoc draw? It's certainly, if you pay it in 18, if 26 had passed, you wouldn't consider it an ad hoc draw. It's not a 19 draw. It's not an ad hoc draw. But if that happens, there'll be all kinds of squawking about a double draw. And, you know, so I would say that given the difficulty the House is having finding 21 votes to get a budget out, I'm wondering how you're going to find the votes for a supermajority. And if you can't get a supermajority vote, I'd say the chances of an ad hoc draw go up and up and up as time goes on. And the only way to avoid that ad hoc draw may be to go back and have a draw in 18, which some people would call an ad hoc draw. But that's opinion. It's beyond opinion. It's speculation.
Thank you. Any other comments?
I guess... I'd say if you want to move forward, my recommendation would be to get out of the weeds on this stuff and focus on the goals. We've run that model and run the model and run the model, and to the point that, you know, you tell me or Alexi or Rob a plan and we'll say, well, it's going to look like this, and you enter the numbers and that's pretty much the way it looks on the screen. And people get very lost in the individual details of the plan. As I said, the payout isn't really critical. It's $100, maybe $200 million a year. It's not enough to close the deficit. It's not enough to move you into the unsustainable range. It's just pick a number. They all work. So what I'd suggest is that you focus on goals and try to figure out how you measure whether a fiscal plan is successful. And you do that not by the details of the plan, but by broad things. And some of the measures we use to see if a plan works is, does it maintain the real value of the permanent fund? And we've talked about that already here, and it's a key model output for us. It's linked to the sustainable earnings reserve account, because when we look at the permanent fund, we look at the earnings reserve account plus the corpus and say, together, we should be maintaining the inflation-adjusted value of those. So you're not going to do that if you have ad hoc draws. You're not going to do that if you have an unsustainable draw. So you're really looking at the health of the earnings reserve account, which kind of gives you a key to the health of the permanent fund. Since we can't use the corpus, we're really only talking about using the earnings reserve.
Representative Birch.
I know we've got, I would love to hear the last presentation for the day if we could. I don't know how you're, what you're planning on, but I, you know, if, you know, I'm good with that. If we can
come back later.
No. I if you're about done,
I am. Yeah.
Yeah. I would like to go to our last presentation. You are a rock star in getting these meetings out. We've got our confirmations out. We got, you know, there's not a lot of stuff progressing in this building, and you, my friend, if you get through this, you're making it happen.
Well, that's very generous of you, Representative Birch. To be honest, I'm thinking it may make sense to actually hold off on this presentation until next week, maybe when we have more members and a little bit more time, just so we're not rushed, Tuesday or Thursday next week, and maybe get out a little bit early, just given that we're at 3/7 right now.
Well, it's the most powerful 3/7, so.
I won't say anything to the other 4/7. but any concluding remarks, Mr. Teal?
No, just wrapping up, the things we look at on a successful model is the health of the CBR, and of course that's linked to deficits, and then the PFD, which there's no right answer on. You can pay a higher PFD if you have taxes. You can pay a higher PFD if you do certain other things. And, you know, another measure you might use is taxes, because to some people, having any kind of broad-based tax required to balance or to have a successful plan means the plan is not a success. But again, those are just measures we use. I think everybody should have their own measures, and theoretically those measures are going to be real close. And if you can agree on the goals, then you'll see that the details aren't as important as they seem to be in some of these plans. People get wedded to their specific payout rate. There's a specific thing, a linkage that they really want in there, and I don't think it's necessary. I think a successful plan can be, you pick a rate, you pay the rate, you don't do ad hoc draws, and you pay a PFD that you believe is affordable. It may not be full, but, you know, that doesn't kill you to pay a dividend once. You just can't do it long term. And I think that's the key here, is to look ahead and look at sustainability of a plan instead of just looking, how do we get out of here?
Thank you very much. Well, 4:43, we'll roll over this last presentation to next week. Thank you very much, Mr. Teal, Mr. Adell. Next week's meetings have been noticed. We've got all of 5 bills up in committee on top of the presentation, so it will be a full week. And we've also noticed a Saturday meeting. It may or may not be canceled, but wanted to have it noticed to preserve the option. And with that, we are adjourned.